It is 6:02, and Kathleen Mainland is in the studio, and it's a pleasure to welcome you, Kathleen. How are you?
I'm just fine, thank you.
And you were the first one to mention St. David's Day on air a month ago in February.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't put you up to it.
No, you didn't. But we who are not English know all the other dates.
Absolutely. So do you have some interesting selections for us today, Kathleen?
I sincerely hope you find it interesting. I'm about to downsize. I'm going into a retirement complex, and I came across this from 1991, The Highlander, and it's about the Honours of Scotland by Archie MacGregor. The Honours of Scotland are the crown, sceptre and sword of state, the emblems of royal power and sovereignty when Scotland was a separate kingdom. Kings have worn crowns as their personal symbol since the beginning of recorded history. In ancient Greece, the cradle of civilization, the kings of the city-states wore a headband of gold or bronze with a precious stone fixed to the front. The Roman kings initially wore laurel wreaths, later made of gold, before adopting the Greek circlet. The later emperors of the Holy Roman Empire wore highly ornate helmets when commanding their armies, and gradually the headband and the war helmet became amalgamated into the shape of a crown. The kings of the Germanic tribes copied the Roman fashion. The first recorded coronation is that of Clovis, king of the Franks, who was converted to Christianity in 496 AD. And was the first monarch to be consecrated by anointing with oil and have a crown placed on his head by a priest. By the 9th century AD, virtually every king in Europe was crowned with this religious ritual. The exceptions were the kings of Ireland and Scotland, the last of the Celtic kingdoms. The earliest record of a royal inauguration in Scotland is that of King Aidan of Dalriada, which is modern Argyll, whom St. Columba declared king at Iona in 574 AD. The Scots of Dalriada later moved east to conquer the Picts from 843 AD. The kings of a united Scotland were placed on the sacred stone of destiny at Scone on their accession to the throne. Some of the early Scottish kings are depicted on their seals as wearing crowns, although there is no evidence that a crown played any part in the ceremony. It was sufficient that the king was, quote, made, unquote, upon the stone. At the inauguration of Alexander II in 1214, it is recorded that the seven great earls of Scotland were present in their order of precedence, Fife, Strathearn, Athol, Angus, Menteith, Buchan, and Lothian, and they played an important part in the proceedings. The Earls of Fife had the privilege of placing the crown on the king's head as they descended from the royal house of Dalriada. The Earl of Strathearn placed the wand or sceptre in the king's hand, and the Earl of Angus handed him the sword. Alexander III, the last truly Celtic monarch, is shown on his great seal, wearing a crown and holding the sceptre and sword at his inauguration at Scone in 1249. Tragically, he was killed when his horse fell over a cliff at Kinghorn in Fife in 1286, and he left no direct heirs. Several claimants came forward, and the succession became a matter of dispute. Edward I of England was asked to mediate and chose John Balliol as a puppet king. But Balliol began to show too much independence, and in 1296 Edward removed him from power and ruled Scotland himself. The Scottish royal regalia, perhaps of Celtic workmanship and dating to the early 11th century or earlier, was taken south to London, where it was probably destroyed around 1650 during the Commonwealth of Oliver Cromwell. Edward also removed the sacred stone of destiny from Scone, on which the Scottish kings were made, although it seems likely that he was given a fake. Thus, when Robert the Bruce was declared King of Scots in 1306, he had no regalia to wear at his hasty inauguration, although it is probable the real Stone of Destiny was brought out from its hiding place for the occasion. A gold circlet was made by a local goldsmith and placed on Bruce's head by the Countess of Fife, whose family of Macduff held this hereditary right. The crown was also lost shortly thereafter when the Scots were surprised and routed at the Battle of Methven, and Bruce's golden circlet was captured and taken to England. And it doesn't mention it in this article, but the Countess of Fife was later taken prisoner by Edward of England, and her punishment was that she was hung in a cage on the outside of Berwick Castle. Bruce seems to have had a proper crown made in the shape of a circlet of gold elevated with fleur-de-lis, which he wore around his helmet at the Battle of Bannockburn in 1314. That's when he beat the English. The next record of the regalia comes at the accession of David II in 1331, when a small sceptre was made by Coppin, the goldsmith, for the boy king. He was the first Scots monarch to be consecrated by anointing with oil, and the crown placed on his head by a bishop. Pope Alexander VI gifted a sceptre to James IV in 1494, which was refashioned by James V into its present form. The rod is made of gilded silver, ornamented with engraved fleur-de-lis and thistles, while the head is flanked with dolphins, between which are three small figures representing the Virgin Mary, St. James, and St. Andrew, who is the patron saint of Scotland. Above this is a globe of pure rock crystal with a Scottish pearl fixed on top. Then, in 1507, Pope Julius II gifted James IV the present sword of state along with a sword belt and a consecrated hat. This was presented to James in the Abbey of Holyrood by the papal envoy. The blade of the sword is 3 foot 3 inches long and engraved with gold-filled etchings depicting the apostles Peter and Paul. The handle is made of gilded silver and decorated with oak leaves and acorns, the insignia of Pope Julius. The scabbard is made of wood covered with crimson velvet and embellished with silver gilt ornamentation. The sword belt consists of a silver buckle and belt of magnificent lacework into which is worked the oak leaf and acorn motifs. The total length is 59 inches. 2 pairs of holes were made much later to reduce the buckled length to 28 inches, perhaps to fit around the slender waist of Mary, Queen of Scots. The crown worn by Robert the Bruce was remodelled by order of James V in 1540. The band of gold, about 1.5 inches high and 8 inches in diameter, was now heightened with 10 crosses, fleury enriched with pearls and topaz. Around the band was placed 22 precious stones set in gold interposed with pearls. The gold came from Crawford Muir and the pearls from the River Tay. From the circle spring 2 full arches, the sign of independent and hereditary monarchy, and at their intersection lies an orb of gold, powdered with stars, above which is a golden cross patee. The bonnet was made of velvet and satin by one Thomas Arthur, although it has been replaced 4 times since then. Mary, daughter of James V, was crowned at Stirling in 1543 when she was 9 months old, but was forced to abdicate in 1568 in favour of her son, James VI. Her followers continued to hold Edinburgh Castle, in which was kept the honours of Scotland, and when the young king held a parliament in Stirling in 1571, he had to use some hastily made substitutes, quote, because the principal jewels were in the castle of Edinburgh and might not be had, end quote. The regalia was recovered when the castle surrendered in 1574. James's son, Charles I, was crowned at Holyrood in 1633, and in the coronation procession the crown was borne by the Marquess of Douglas, the sceptre by the Earl of Rothes, and the sword of state by the Earl of Buchan. The king was anointed by the Archbishop of St. Andrews, who placed the crown on his head and gave into the king's hands the sceptre and sword. After the surrender of Charles I to the English parliamentarian forces under Cromwell and his subsequent execution in 1649, the army of Oliver Cromwell entered Scotland in 1650 and defeated the Scots at Dunbar. The honours of Scotland were taken from Edinburgh Castle before Cromwell arrived and preserved at some place unknown. They were brought out for the coronation of Charles II on New Year's Day 1651, the last time a king was crowned in Scotland, and the last time the ceremony was held at Scone. A tiny kirk had replaced the great abbey on the ancient Moot Hill of Scone, and in the procession to this the sword of state was carried by the Earl of Crawford and Lindsay, and the crown was carried by the Marquess of Argyll, who placed it on the king's head. The Lord Lion King at Arms called forward the nobility to swear fealty before the king appeared outside the door of the church to acknowledge the cheers from the onlookers. Charles II and his Scots army were defeated by Cromwell in 1651 and the king fled into exile. Cromwell formally united Scotland with the English Commonwealth and abolished the Scottish Parliament. The honours of Scotland were taken for safety to Dunottar Castle on its great cliff above the sea on the Glencardineshire coast, the home of the Keiths, hereditary Earls Marshal of Scotland. The small garrison of 40 men was commanded by Sir George Ogilvy of Barras, who bravely defied the besieging Cromwellian army. Food and water were running short, and when surrender seemed likely, his wife thought of a plan to protect the honours. Her friend, Christian Fletcher, wife of the minister of nearby Kineff Church, approached the English commander of the besieging forces and asked permission to visit her friend and remove some rolls of lint. The officer bowed and declared, "We do not make war on women, madam," and allowed her to proceed. Once inside, Mrs. Fletcher placed the crown beneath her skirt, and the sceptre and sword were put in the rolls of flax carried by her maid. The pair left the castle, and the officer, noticing that Mrs. Fletcher was apparently pregnant, gallantly assisted her onto her horse. The Reverend Fletcher first put the honours at the foot of his bed, and then he and his wife buried them in the ground in front of the pulpit. Dunottar Castle was forced to surrender in June 1652, one of the conditions being that the crown and sceptre of Scotland, together with all other ensigns of regality, be delivered for the use of Parliament. The besiegers were furious when they found that the honours had disappeared. The governor and his wife were imprisoned and tortured, but refused to speak. Brave Mrs. Ogilvy died from her ill treatment, but her husband never betrayed the secret. The regalia was kept hidden for 9 years, and every 3 months the Reverend Fletcher and his wife would dig up the honours at night to air them before a fire and preserve them from damp and injury. In 1660, Charles II was restored to the throne, and the honours could at last be returned to Edinburgh Castle. Ogilvy of Barras, the gallant governor, was granted a baronetcy, while Mrs. Granger was awarded just 2,000 marks. The regalia continued to be produced at the meeting of the Scottish Parliament until 1707, when the Union of Parliaments brought this to an end. The Treaty of the Act of Union specifically stated, "And the crown, sceptre and sword of state, records of Parliament and other records, rolls and registers whatsoever, continue to be kept as they are in that part of the United Kingdom now called Scotland, and that they so remain in all time coming, notwithstanding of the Union." That was with England. In March 1707, the honours of Scotland were placed in a locked oak chest in the Crown Room, which was also locked, and they were never seen again until a century had passed. Suspicion grew that they had been secretly taken to England, and in 1819 Sir Walter Scott persuaded the commissioners of the Treasury to force open the locked chest for which the key had been lost. To everyone's delight, the regalia was found lying at the foot, covered with linen cloths and unharmed save for dust and tarnish. They were brought forth with great ceremony, and a guard of honour was provided by the chief of Clan MacGregor and his clansmen. The sword belt had an even more remarkable story, being bricked into a wall of Barras House, where it was discovered in 1790 by Sir David Ogilvy and restored to its proper place with the rest of the regalia in 1893. Today, and this is 1991 as I said, the honours of Scotland are on display in a high security cage in the Crown Room of Edinburgh Castle, along with other items of the Crown jewels. I think they're still there. In 1953, the royal regalia was taken in procession to St Giles Cathedral in Edinburgh and borne before the newly crowned Queen Elizabeth II at a service of dedication. This was the first time in 300 years the crown had been brought forth, although the sword of state is used at the infrequent installations of the knights of the most noble order of the thistle. The royal regalia of England, dating back to the time of Alfred the Great, was destroyed by order of Oliver Cromwell in 1651. The honours of Scotland are thus the oldest regalia in the United Kingdom, and it is thanks to a number of dedicated Scottish patriots that they have survived the centuries intact. They symbolise Scotland's sovereignty as a separate kingdom for over 1,000 years. And that's the Honours of Scotland by Archie MacGregor.
And you always bring us such interesting pieces, Kathleen. I enjoyed listening to that, and I even more enjoy listening to it when I'm not in the studio, when I replay the tapes.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
You're listening to The Celtic Show on WRFG 89.3 Atlanta. We just heard from Kathleen Mainland, our Scottish storyteller, who comes to us the first Sunday of every month. When are you moving?
Probably about the middle of this month.
Uh-huh.
But I'm only going into Buckhead.
Okay.
Not far.
Okay. So you'll still be able to come and...
Oh, yes.
Oh, well.
Oh, yes.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming today, and happy St. David's Day to you as well.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Okay. I hope you'll stay with us as we continue with our celebration of the music of Wales.
Gwell mae ambell un yn dal i gan i'r delyn a'r parhau o hyd yn parhau i diwnio'r hys o danau.
How lovely to hear a lady female choir. That was the Richard Williams Singers performing Beguiliur Gwenith Gwyn, Watching the White Wheat, from a CD called Themes and Dreams of Wales on the Black Mountain Records label. In the middle, we heard from another lady, Gwenan Gibbard, who's a harpist and singer from North Wales. And she was performing two selections. Adelin, the harp, was the first one, and she was singing that to one tune, and the harp was playing a different tune, but they have to end up at the same place at the end. And then she followed that by Gwenanin Gwent, the Bee of Gwent, from her CD called A Gwenith Gwynev, the Whitest Wheat, and that's on the sign label. And the set started with the Vron Male Voice Choir. Vron is a shortened version of their full place name, Vron Cysillte, and that's in North Wales. And their selection was Ar Lan y Môr from a CD called Voices of the Valley Encore on the Universal Classics and Jazz label. And that choir, it's got an average age in the high 70s, I think, but they've done spectacularly well with that CD and the one that preceded it. It shot to the top of the charts in Britain and Australia, and they're starting promoting themselves much more overseas. They have a very nice sound, so the Vron Male Voice Choir. We're now going to go to a song that you'll know, but you won't know the words. I hope you enjoy it. You're listening to The Celtic Show on WRFG 89.3 FM. We stream online at the website, which is www.wrfg.org. And the telephone number here in the studio, if you'd like to call in to talk about the music, is 404-523-8989. If you go to the website, you will find the show page for The Celtic Show. You'll be able to see the playlist of the music that we play each week, and we aim to get that up on the website within a couple of days after the Sunday show. So you can check up on the spelling of all these names that many people seem unpronounceable, but I assure you they're not. Anyway, stay tuned, and I hope you enjoy.
O deir gogledd o boni tia mi. Mae'r wlad hon yn eiddo i tia mi. Mae'r wlad hon yn eiddo i tia mi.
Hibbler great or what? This is Stuart Myers, host of Plain Old Horizons, Sundays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., where you can hear a variety of music from my generation and maybe yours. Be there.
Are you still mine? I need your love. I need your love. God, speed your love to me.
And before that announcement, we were listening to Hogir Bonk. Hogir means boys, and Bonk is a gallery in a slate quarry. So it's the gallery boys from the slate quarrying district of North Wales. And they were performing Mae'n Wlad I Mi, This Land is My Land. Obviously, that's the Woody Guthrie song and tune. But the Welsh words were written by Dafydd Iwan. And that's from Hogir Bonk's CD, Un Cam a Nes, One Step Nearer on the sign label. We followed that with Llio Rhydderch performing Waltz Treforest, the Treforest Waltz, from her CD Melangell on the Flach label. It can be quite difficult to find CDs, Welsh CDs, in the shops here, but Sign and Flach have websites, so if you Google them, you can go to them and find CDs that way. We are now going to hear a set of tunes that could be described as nonsense songs. I hope you'll enjoy them.
Krieg ich irgendwann mal hin, aber
And that was the Mrs. Ackroyd Band performing Llanfair PG, a feat of spelling if ever there was one, from their CD called Oranges and Lemmings, put out by Mrs. Ackroyd Records. And I'd like to thank our fellow host Dave Ayton for telling me about that piece. It's basically a song about the place in North Wales, which is the longest place name in the British Isles. And it's Llanfair Pwllgwyngyll Gogerr y Chwyrndrobyll Llantysilio Gogo Goch. And one of these days, the next time, I'll tell you exactly what it means. It's a descriptive name about the Church of St. Mary by the White Hollow and the Hazel Tree and the Whirlpool and so on and so forth. In the middle, we heard from Carnarvon Male Choir performing Sospan Vach, a little saucepan boiling on the fire. And that's from a CD called Carn o Gymru on the sign label. And the set started with Sean James performing Cyfri Geirfa, Counting the Goats. And that can be quite a tongue twister as well. It's from her CD Peer on the Boss record label. And I hope you enjoyed that selection of funny songs. Let me recap briefly some of the performances that you're going to be able to see coming up for St. Patrick's Day. Lunasa is performing at Spivey Hall on the 14th of March. The Michael O'Neill Singers are at Roswell United Methodist Church, also on the 14th of March. And the Cobb Symphony Orchestra is performing a Tiny Tots concert at the Murray Arts Centre in Kennesaw on the 15th of March. Then Pogue is performing at the Loafing Leprechaun in Alpharetta on 17th of March, St. Patrick's Day. So plenty to look forward for the Irish celebrations. The next set of tunes could be called Activist Songs, and again, I hope you'll stay tuned and enjoy those. It is 1846, 6:46 on Sunday, the 2nd of March, and I hope you're going to stay tuned for Fox's Minstrel Show coming up at 7 o'clock.
As if I wasn't there, but But everyone gave up his fight for life. I lost my mom one night, and then my father, and I was left alone in all this strife. But I was born the only son of my parents, and they taught me how to pray and to forgive. They said that we belong to one another, so why am I denied the right to live? Oh, I've heard about those mountains full of butter, and those lakes of milk they say must always stay. But I know that Christian folks would not allow them to spoil and waste good food in such a way. But I was born the only son of my parents, and they taught me how to pray and to forgive.
Was Cor Maibion Maelgwn, the male choir of Maelgwn, performing an English language version of David Ewan's song, The Right to Live. In Welsh, that's Hawl I Fyw, and that's on a CD called Anthem Geltaidd on the Sign label. And David wrote that back in the 80s when we were going through the dreadful sight of the famine in Ethiopia, The Right to Live. And before that, Carol Ebenezer was performing a poem by one of Wales's foremost poets, Waldo Williams, Y Tang Na Fyddwyr, The Peacemakers. He wrote the poem in the Second World War when Swansea was, along with London, the first city to be bombed by the German Air Force in World War II. So it's a peace activist song. We're going to go out with a song that's a favourite of John and mine, and I mentioned his name just a short while ago. It's been a pleasure being with you here today, performing this special programme to celebrate the Music of Wales for St David's Day, and I look forward to being with you the next time. Take care. Bye-bye.
Does never in a bodo, my mila chwechant of another, and I'm ser here in co. On I Magnus Maximus of Gumre, and of Lloyd in Trichanto is three, and Gadael and Gened Gavan, I have you. said